My name is Jennifer Natoli. I'm going to talk to you today about land grabs. I first learned about land grabbing in Dakar, Senegal during the 2011 World Social Forum, which, as many of you might already know, is a huge activist summit held annually at various locations around the globe. While at the summit, I was handed a briefing entitled Seize, the 2008 Land Grab for Food and Financial Security. It's published by Grain, a small nonprofit organization out of Spain. This briefing has been credited as the first publication on land grabs, igniting a global discussion on the topic while highlighting the correlations between the 2007-2008 global financial crisis and the global food crisis, which occurred in tandem, triggering the worldwide land grab. Land grabbing is a global phenomenon involving the purchase or long-term lease of large tracts of land from predominantly poor developing nations by wealthier food insecure countries, as well as private entities, to produce food and/or agri-fuels for export. It is important to unpack what land grabbing actually involves if we are to fully grasp what is occurring. The best way to understand land grabbing is through the lens of the political economy. From this perspective, land grabbing is essentially control grabbing, because it is the power to control land and other related resources, such as water, minerals, or forests, as a means to control the benefits of their use. In other words, land grabbing shifts the use of farmland from small-scale, labor-intensive uses like subsistence agriculture towards large-scale, capital-intensive, resource-depleting uses such as industrial monocultures and raw material extraction. Contemporary land grabbing dynamics are multicentric because grabbers are coming from all hemispheres and all continents. Yet there are three main factors and four types of investors that are fueling land grabs. The main drivers are food security, a demand for agrofuels, and a drastic rise in investments in both the land market and the soft commodities market. The key players involved in land grabs are foreign governments, domestic and international corporations, private equity firms, and wealthy individuals. So let's start with food security. There are a number of factors currently threatening food security, such as economic and demographic growth, increasingly harsh climatic conditions, soil degradation, water scarcity, and the global food crisis of 2007-2008, which led to increased import bills and inflation rates. This culmination of factors has led many countries, particularly in the Middle East and Asia, to re-examine domestic food security policies. Countries such as Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, China, and South Korea are severely running out of water, while their populations are simultaneously growing. Many governments are looking to stabilize food supplies by acquiring foreign lands for food production as a means of averting social unrest and political instability as food prices continue to fall victim to a volatile market. So looking at this region, for example, Qatar, with only 1% of its land suitable for farming, has purchased 40,000 hectares of land in Kenya for crop production, secured deals in Vietnam and Cambodia for rice production, and finalized a land deal in Sudan for oil, wheat, and corn production. The United Arab Emirates typically imports 85% of its food. After feeling the economic pangs of the food crisis, it purchased 324,000 hectares of farmland in Pakistan in June of 2008. China has been heavily investing in African states, purchasing over 100,000 hectares in Zimbabwe and investing $800 million in Mozambique to expand rice production in both states. South Korea has acquired over 1 million hectares of land in Sudan, Mongolia, Indonesia, and Argentina. The second motivator behind land grabs is the surge in demand for agri-fuels to meet growing energy and manufacturing needs. There are two main types of agri-fuel, ethanol and biodiesel. Ethanol is typically produced from sugarcane, corn, wheat, or barley. Biodiesel is derived from vegetable oil, such as rapeseed, soya, jatropha, or the highly controversial palm oil. The demand for agri-fuels has increased rapidly as oil-dependent countries have set ambitious targets to incorporate agri-fuel production into their energy schemes. Much of this fervor is due to rising oil prices and fears of energy scarcity in the upcoming decades. Responding to this recent demand, investors, primarily from the private sector and OECD member countries, are gobbling up huge tracts of land. Developing countries have been targeted due to low labor costs, cheap land prices, and in some cases, land availability. Agri-fuels are often justified on environmental terms as carbon neutral fuels. However, claims that agri-fuels are carbon neutral and renewable have been increasingly questioned as it ignores the emissions that result from collecting, transporting, processing, and burning the biofuel as the biomass as fuel, as well as the impacts of removing trees, plants, and related biomass that would have otherwise continued to absorb carbon had they been left in the ground. The third motivator behind land grabs is greed from private investors who view farmland as an investment poised to produce significant returns. Countless Western investors, including Wall Street banks and wealthy individuals, have amped up investments in agricultural land. For example, Morgan Stanley purchased 40,000 hectares of farmland in Ukraine. In September 2008, Goldman Sachs assumed the rights over China's poultry and meat industries, including the rights to their farmland. A New York-based money management firm, BlackRock, Inc., set up a $200 million agricultural hedge fund, allocating at least $30 million of which to be used for the acquisition of farmland. The surge in farmland investments can be explained by a shift from a hard commodities to a soft commodities market. Now, traditionally, investors have skirted away from land investment because land presents a myriad of problems for investors, such as uncertainty of financial returns and other issues regarding access, security, use, and consistency of production. However, in 2007, soft commodities overtook hard commodities due to a strong demand from emerging economies such as China, India, and Central Europe. This, in conjunction with the demand for bioenergy discussed before, led to an unprecedented scramble for land by private investors. Reallocation processes are taking place under diverse political legal conditions, with some illegal and others perfectly legal. Some of the most prominent cases of land grabbing involve physical harassment, intimidation, and violence of the people residing on the land. Land grabbing is not new. In many regions in the global south, land was first grabbed by pre-colonial rulers during territorial wars with each other, then by colonial governments, and increasingly by foreign or domestic corporations. Throughout history, corporate agribusiness has been quick to establish itself in developing nations, with the intention of either driving independent farmers off their lands or converting these farmers into a class of workers within a new plantation system. Transnational corporations are often lured into foreign countries by subsidies from the host countries, with their claims of increasing employment and improving infrastructure legitimizing their arrival. History has proven, however, that the introduction of large-scale agriculture in areas once dominated by small-scale subsistence farmers can lead to social unrest, socioeconomic inequalities, negative implications for land reform, increased dependence of locals on foreign markets, and political upheaval. In addition, this transition is often responsible for exacerbating food insecurity instead of combating hunger. There are a number of factors which distinguish the most recent wave of land grabbing from its predecessor. Firstly, current land grabbing is unfolding at a relatively fast pace, set by changing dynamics in the global food regime, in energy security responses to peak oil, in environmental protection in the context of climate change, and in the international flow of financial capital searching for safe investments after the collapse of housing markets in the global north. Second, today's land grabs are massive. They involve large-scale acquisitions of land never seen before in history. Third, present land grabs are characterized by long-term leases or outright purchase of land. Typical land leases range from 30 to 50 or even up to 99 years at a time, often with the option for renewal. And fourth, the trend has become global in scope. While the bulk of the deals appear to be unfolding in Africa, where about 70% of land grabs are happening, research shows that it is also happening virtually everywhere, throughout South and Central America, throughout South and Southeast Asia, and in many parts of the global north, particularly in the former Soviet Union. There are several misconceptions facilitating and justifying land grabs, but we're going to discuss three prominent ones. The first myth is that the world has an availability of excess land that with some investment can be turned into income and generate jobs in developing nations. More often than not, the lands being targeted are portrayed on paper as empty, marginal, idle, and unoccupied. The World Bank has championed this myth, citing the existence of vast reserves of land to the tune of 445 million to 1.7 billion hectares available worldwide. Yet the reality is that these lands are not empty, idle, or unused, especially since investors are going after the best, most arable lands, which tend to already be occupied by rural farmers. The second myth is that agriculture desperately needs investment, particularly foreign investment. The assumption is that the ongoing rural crisis of chronic poverty and persistent hunger is due to a lack of investment. This is a fallacy when, in fact, agricultural investment is typically undertaken by farmers themselves, with smallholder farmers producing most of the food consumed locally in many developing nations. And a third very powerful misconception fueling land grabs involves scarcity, both food scarcity and oil scarcity. The food scarcity argument falls short when closely examined because advocates of large-scale land grabs fail to acknowledge that there is already more than enough food in the world to feed everybody. Food security is actually undermined by costs, loss of harvests, waste, and the diversion of farmland to grow non-food products such as animal feed and agri-fuels. It is virtually impossible to know how much land grabbing is taking place. For instance, by World Bank estimates, 45 million hectares have been purchased or leased. Yet, Oxfam argues the number is closer to 227 million. One issue with tracking land grabs is that many land deals are simply not reported. They take place in secrecy and are either not covered by the media or unreported. But even if each and every land deal was reported, it would still be impossible to pin down the numbers for a variety of reasons. First, the projects involved in reported land acquisitions can be at widely different stages of planning and operation, with some just initial and others more advanced. And second, the financing behind the projects is fluid and can change abruptly, as happened with the Procana sugarcane plantation project in Mozambique, for which 30,000 hectares of land was taken in 2007. Yet the project was abruptly ended in 2009, just 2 years later, after some key investors backed out. But not before thousands of villagers were expelled and nearly 1,000 hectares had been cleared and planted with sugarcane. Land converted to the production of food, animal feed, and fuel crop monocultures requires a secure and stable supply of large volumes of water over time, usually through large-scale irrigation. Hence, land grabbing and water grabbing are deeply intertwined. Investors in large-scale agricultural projects are not likely to grab land without also obtaining a water source. Securing water is often part of the land lease or purchase contract between the investor and the government. Many proponents of large-scale land acquisitions insist that they can benefit local people, mainly through employment and economic arrangements and through new social and economic infrastructure. However, so far, there is little concrete evidence to back up such claims. There is growing evidence, however, which suggests that the impacts of land grabbing on rural poor communities and ecosystems have been largely catastrophic thus far. Local people are being expelled from their lands and either forcibly relocated to internally displaced persons' camps or incorporated into the new enterprises because not only their land, but also their labor is desired. Although villages are supposed to be compensated for their lands, there have been many broken promises, such as issues with payments for damages, resettlement in improved conditions, and compensation. In cases of expulsion, loss of land is a huge blow for people living at the margins. Giving them a one-time fee for their property and forcefully evicting them from their land cannot even begin to make up for the loss of their food-producing land. When labor is needed, not all cases turn out negatively, but more frequently than not, it does turn out badly, precisely because the critical conditions that could potentially enable local people to achieve a powerful presence at the negotiating table tend not to be present in areas targeted by investors. As a result, those who are incorporated are generally left to struggle, often alone and in isolation, against many odds to achieve even the minimum threshold of decency in wages and working conditions. In addition, many investors prefer to hire children to work in these newly industrialized fields because they are easily manipulated and will work for less money, as several investigations in Ethiopia have shown. Three distinct platforms have emerged in the global land grab debate. The first platform supports land grabs, but argues for regulation in order to facilitate land investment. It is premised on the belief that large-scale land deals are desirable. They're a desirable trend where states and the corporate sector have become interested in land and that good governance can be guaranteed through strengthened property rights, environmental and labor standards, greater community consultation, and the use of some international government instruments such as transparency mechanisms in order to facilitate capital accumulation. This position is compatible with that of the World Bank. The second platform proposes regulation to mitigate negative impacts and maximize opportunities. It usually asks the question, since land grabs are happening, how can these deals be made more accountable and transparent in order to benefit poor people? This ideology is tied to the assumption of inevitability of large-scale land deals and the impossibility of redistributive land and rural development policies to promote small-scale farming-based development. As a means of securing at least some benefits to rural poor communities, this stance advocates strengthening property rights to protect the land rights of people, environmental and labor standards, greater community consultation, and the use of transparency instruments. This position is supported by some of the United Nations, some governments, and some parts of civil society. A third, more radical platform calls for regulation to stop and roll back land grabbing altogether. It is premised on the belief that the contemporary expansion for production of biofuels, food, feed, and other crops are not intended to solve world hunger and poverty or curb environmental degradation, but rather they are used for further capital accumulation and the insatiable corporate hunger for profits. This position is maintained by various social movements and peasant groups, most notably the peasant farmer association La Via Campesina. Land sovereignty is the right of working peoples to have effective access to, use of, and control over land and the benefits of its use. Simply put, land sovereignty is the ideology of a realization of the human right to land. It looks to build on the strengths of traditional calls for land security and land reform. Land sovereignty is intrinsically linked with the growing global movement for food sovereignty. In the current global debate over land grabbing, investment tends to be equated with corporate investment that is skewed towards large-scale, petrol-based, and capital-intensive labor-expelling ventures. A fundamental starting point when talking about systemic change to end land grabbing is to bring in two other types of investment, namely public investment and investments by small-scale farmers. Under neoliberalism, state-driven investments in agriculture have dried up, while investments by small-scale farmers are often made invisible. The urgent task is to revive state investment while making investments by small-scale farmers more visible. It is the combination of state and small farmers' investments that make any systemic change to end land grabbing possible. And it is important to take in the philosophy and practice of agroecology. It needs to be taken seriously in this joint investment framework. Agroecology captures the need for social equity and ecological sustainability. Governments should be supporting the spread of agroecological farming methods as a means of boosting local food supply and mitigating climate change. And lastly, there are two broad types of resistance occurring right now to combat land grabs. The first is a defensive struggle to resist expulsion of people from the land or resistance against the appropriation of their water and other resources. So this is essentially people just fighting to stay on the land. The second type is a proactive struggle, where local communities occupy and enclose their land, water, or forest, and develop alternative livelihoods and production systems, such as agroecology, to challenge the dominant model of industrial agriculture. Both types are life and death struggles for subsistence farmers. In most successful struggles, the most successful struggles often use a multiple range of tactics, including direct action, mass mobilization, and legal strategies, applying pressure on all key points of the chain of dispossession. And I would like to conclude with a quote from La Via Campesina. It says, some people say that land grabbing is modernizing agriculture and that it is the only solution to alleviating hunger. This is not true. What we need is food sovereignty. We must fight for our agroecological model, and we need policies that support family farmers everywhere. It is urgent to implement an agrarian reform all over the world. Paul Nicholson, one of the many leaders of La Via Campesina. I'm not sure if Friends of the Earth in Indonesia is here. Are they here? No? Okay, I'm supposed to be co-presenting with Friends of the Earth Indonesia. And the reason why it was supposed to be Friends of the Earth Indonesia is because Indonesia is experiencing heaps of land grabs, most notably for their palm oil. Right now, Indonesia has been bumped up to the third largest emitter of carbon, of greenhouse gases in the world, and it's because of the destruction of their rainforests. The island of Sumatra alone, I think, has about 8.2 million hectares of land that has been cleared for palm oil production, and about one-third of all arable land in Indonesia has now been converted into palm oil producing lands. And this has been a huge blow for the biodiversity in Indonesia. The animals such as, I think they have a Sumatran tiger or something, right? They have this, they have a lion or tiger that's threatened. Orangutans are threatened. And also people are being forcefully evicted off their lands, which were once communally held. But I don't think they're here to talk about it. So, do you guys have any questions about land grabs?
How is agroecology
being connected with worldwide indigenous moves to sovereignty?
Mm-hmm. So agroecology is people living in harmony with the land, and instead of using the Western ideology of planting huge monocultures, and even if you're growing organic produce. Right now, organic produce is being grown in a monoculture system. It's not always using agroecological methods because that has to be done on a small-scale movement. So right now, you have a lot of indigenous farmers who own very small plots of land. The average land size, I believe, is like 1 to 2 hectares. And for them, it's a lot easier to implement agroecological methods. And it's also more beneficial for them because then they're not depleting the soil as rapidly. They're using plot rotations, allowing the land to lay fallow. And allowing the land to lie fallow and implementing different crops during different seasons. So agroecological methods are something that indigenous peoples have been doing for a very long time. It's only now that there's this big craze around it because we're seeing the effects of these huge monocultured farms all over the world that are literally just depleting the earth of its resources, ripping the nitrogen out of the soil, and then leaving just dust in its place. It takes about 100 years for 1 inch of topsoil to occur naturally, and right now we're just destroying the world's topsoil at unprecedented speed. We've never seen this happen this quickly before. So La Via Campesina is a peasant organization. They've been around since about the mid-90s. I believe they started in 1993. They've been championing a lot of things. They are the creators of food sovereignty over food security. Do you guys know about food sovereignty versus food security? Okay, so food security is a concept developed by the United Nations. It's a really great concept. It says that as human beings, we deserve to have the right to 3 meals a day. We deserve to know that we are going to have 3 meals a day. And that's what is in the premise of food security. But La Via Campesina is it's a loosely organized transnational peasant organization, and they fought for this concept of food sovereignty, which says yes, every human being deserves to have 3 meals a day, and yes, we deserve to know that we're going to have our next meal, but what's also very important is to have culturally appropriate food. And so it's not about receiving food aid, it's not about eating grains from the U.S. or corn from the U.S. or wherever it's coming from. It's about having the right to consume the food that we are growing that is culturally appropriate to us, to our country. And so they fought very hard for food sovereignty. Right now they're spearheading the concept of land sovereignty, which is that if you work the land, you have rights to that land. And they also have been huge proponents of the fair trade over free trade movement. So they say, if you want our produce, we deserve to have a fair price for it. They're pretty awesome. And they're all over the world. They're in about 170 countries. Any other questions?
Can you tell us a little bit about
the Mm-hmm, absolutely. So I am Puerto Rican American. My grandparents all come from... Three of my grandparents come from developing countries. My mother is Puerto Rican Mexican, my father's Italian Argentinian, and all of my grandparents immigrated into America. So I'm first generation American, and I grew up in New York City in Puerto Rico. And growing up in Puerto Rico, we have very close ties to the land. My great grandfather was a manager of a sugarcane plantation. So I grew up completely obsessed with campesinos and the work that farmers do. And as such, I always knew that I wanted to work in Latin America. I always knew that I wanted to work with small-scale subsistence farmers. Being an activist, in 2011, I decided to go to the World Social Forum in Dakar, Senegal. And it was at the forum where I first learned about land grabbing, because being held in West Africa, several African farmers came across the continent to talk to us about what was happening to them, particularly in Ethiopia. A lot of farmers have been expelled there. I believe about 1.5 million farmers have been kicked off their land in Ethiopia in a very brutal way. It's probably one of the most brutal regions right now as far as farmers being forcefully evicted off their land. And they started this discussion. Livia Campesina was there, and landless peasant movements from all over the world were talking about how to fend off land grabbers. So I became obsessed with the issue, and I went on to do my master's degree, and I did all of my master's work in this, and I just finished my master's in global development, but I specifically focused on land grab. And right now, I'm in the process of working towards my PhD, actually, and I want to look at land grabs happening in Latin America and in Africa, and to see if there's any correlations in peasant resistance movements, and see if there's any way to replicate what's happening in Latin America, where they've been a little bit more successful at fending off grabbers, in Africa, where they're not successful at all. Africa's probably the worst hit region for land grabs right now. Any other questions? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, specifically in Africa. That's where the bulk of the land deals are happening. About 70% of all land grabs are happening in Africa. And they're happening in a couple key states, Ethiopia, Tanzania, Mozambique, Zambia. These are some pretty targeted areas. So in a lot of these countries, they have communally held land. But the land isn't actually communally held. It's in the Constitution, it's held by the government. It's just that for the past couple of centuries, the government has allowed people to live on the land and do what they wish with the land because nobody wanted the land anyways. As I mentioned, before 2007, investors were not looking at land. Land has always been viewed as a commodity that you simply just stay away from. There's too many problems involved with it. You know what I mean? You literally have to have people patrolling it if you want to maintain it. You have to deal with all of the issues of kicking people off the land because lands are communally held in most developing countries. But in 2000, I'd say about 6 to 2008, that's when the huge surge in land grabs happened. And you had private investors and foreign governments coming and knocking on the doors of these governments in Africa and saying, hey, we'd like to buy your land. And the governments are literally leasing these lands, I kid you not, for a penny a hectare. It is unbelievable. And the governments have every incentive of doing this because they don't really care what happens to the peasants living on these lands. So right now in Ethiopia in particular, 1.5 million people are recorded, it could be more, this is what they've recorded, have been forcefully kicked off their land. What that involves, it usually involves a military-backed junta showing up on your land, unbeknownst to you. They immediately burn down your village, often rape and beat the women, and forcefully evict you off the land. And they do this because they want to make sure that you don't come back. So they burn your village and they burn your food-producing fields. These people are then forcefully relocated into internally displaced persons camps. Now, you would think that the Ethiopian government would have some concern over this because they have to fit the bill for these people being in IDP camps. But that's not the case because Ethiopia is one of the largest receivers of food aid in the world. So it's actually our tax dollars all over the industrialized world that are paying for these people to be maintained in these IDP camps. A lot of people don't know that.
I saw some research that was done at UT recently where, I think it was maybe in Uganda, where they were looking at like carbon offset like plantations where they were forcibly evicting people off the land and, you know, stopping people from being able to access their agricultural land in order to be able to grow, you know, plantations that would then, you know, they could earn money getting carbon credits from that for, I guess, you know, people in the first world, you know, sign up to the programs. Did you come across anything like that?
Yeah, that is actually, so that's been going on more in South America, most notably Brazil. But yes, that is something that is tied to land grabbing, but a little different. So a lot of those programs like the RED programs and things that have been promoted by the UN as ways to offset your carbon footprint at home and all of the cap and trade and carbon trading schemes, they are really detrimental to local peoples in a lot of developing countries, because one of two things happens. Either they will forcefully kick people off their land and say, sorry, you guys can't live here anymore, because this is a, you know, basically a carbon bank. People are going to be buying up this area to offset their carbon at home. Or they may not kick people off their land, but the forests right next to where the people live that they rely on for firewood, for hunting, for fishing, what have you, they're no longer allowed to access. And they will literally have a line of military officers blocking off these forests and enclosing people in very rural areas, very remote areas, with no access to the resources they need to survive. And so that's why the red schemes, the carbon trading, they've come under increasingly harsh criticism over the last, I'd say, probably decade or so, because if you look at what's happening on the ground, in order for us to feel a little bit better about jetting around the world in airplanes or driving down the highway, it's just not justifiable. Yeah, and that's been happening a lot in South America. In Africa, however, it's a little bit more, it really is about securing food and agri-fuels. I'd say you'd be surprised, some of the big grabbers of land right now, some of them are obvious, some of them are not so obvious. India is huge in Africa, particularly in Tanzania and in Ethiopia. They are gobbling up huge tracts of land, and so is China. Now, the Chinese, when they grab the land, they usually bring in their own workers, whereas when the Indian government or Indian corporations grab the land, they usually hire the local populace. But again, they're more concerned about hiring child laborers. There's been some cases in some districts in Ethiopia where child enrollment in the classroom has gone down from 90 students per day to 2 students per day, because this industry came in and was only willing to hire children, and the children went to work to support their family because their family was forcefully kicked off the land. So another big player in Africa too is agri-fuels from Northern Europe, Scandinavia. So there's a lot of small landlocked European countries, for example, Switzerland, and they're really concerned about energy because they know that as the world continues to run out of oil, they'd be crazy to try and fight the United States for the last remaining drops of oil. And it's a sad reality. Most European countries, they're a lot smaller, they're a lot less powerful, and they just don't have the means and might to go secure oil. And those countries, more so than countries like America, are really vying for land to grow agri-fuels. So, any other questions? Agri-fuels? Mm-hmm. Oh, agroecology is known as permaculture. Okay, yeah. In the States, we have both. We have permaculture and agroecology. Yeah, we have both fields of study.
What's the difference?
Let's see. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, agroecology is simply working with the land, and just it's kind of like more of a traditional method of farming. Just, you know, crop rotation, letting the land life follow, whereas permaculture is bringing in the science, so you actually plant certain plants that are nitrogen fixing, and it's a little bit more science heavy than agroecology. Agroecology is often just working with what grows naturally in an area, whereas permaculture really is about like watershed irrigation and like crop cover and all that kind of stuff. It's a little bit more science heavy. It requires a little bit more input than agroecological methods. Any other questions? No? All right. I wish Friends of the Earth was here. Thanks, guys. Thank you for listening.